Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner right here on The Mark Steiner Show and your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We hit our national roundtable today. There's a lot to talk about besides the vote that just took place in Congress over the Health Care Act. The House of Representatives, to be clear, has a long way to go, but it says a lot. We'll talk about that. The announcement today that they're going to remove scientists from EPA panels. Who needs science anyway? We just have to make up our own facts. And then, and also this has pushed all these conservative judges being listed. What will that mean? There's a great deal to talk about there. And of course, the French election that just took place. What does that mean for America? We are here. He's not been on the show for a couple of years. It's great to have him back. It's been our fault, not his. Dr. Jack Fruchtman Jr. is with us, professor of political science, director of the Program of Law and American Civilization, and director of the University Pre-Law Advising at Taos University. Jack, good to have you back.
Delighted to be here, Mark. Thank you.
And Dr. Carsonia Wise Whitehead is with us. Kate Whitehead, of course, is here a great deal and co-hosts the show and substitute hosts on the show. She's Associate Professor of Communication and African-American Studies at Loyola University, Maryland, author of numerous books, including My Black Sons, Raising Boys in a Post-Racial America, and now also as a monthly op-ed writer in the Baltimore Sun.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm so happy to be here,
excited
as
about
always.
That field,
thank you.
And Dr. Anne McCarthy, a lot of doctors in the house today.
Is on the just don't get sick.
just don't get sick. Wrong kind of doctor. Dean of the Business School at Hamline University in Minneapolis. And Anne, good to have you back.
Hi, Mark. It's great to be back.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. You can send an email to talk@steinershow.org. We'd love to hear from you during the course of the show, so please join us at 410-319-8888. So Emmanuel Macron wins the French election. Marie Le Pen is out. It really was pushed back. And it's an interesting election, but how does it affect us? What does that mean for us, do we think? Anything?
Well, I'll start,
Jack,
if that's all right. Yes.
Yeah. Since you haven't said anything on the Steiner Show for a few years.
That's right.
You start.
I'll start with hopefully a reasonably intelligent sentence. First of all, one of the things that is astonishing to me is it seemed to me that President Trump actually endorsed Marine Le Pen and indicated along the way that because of the few terrorist attacks that have taken place in France that she was going to probably win this election, and she did not. On the other hand, one thing that is also astonishing to me is that she did manage to get somewhere around 35% of the vote, which is the largest that the National Front, her party, has ever received. And so it indicates that there is still a lot of unrest and questioning about the where France stays in the world and how it connects with the European Union and the alt-right and nationalism and populist approaches to issues that we face in the United States. And we saw that with our own election last November when Donald Trump defeated Hillary Clinton, not by the popular vote, but by the electoral vote, which is the vote that counts under the Constitution. On the other hand, we've also seen in the Netherlands, Geert Wilders lost, and in Austria, Norbert Hofer also lost.
In a closer election.
In a closer election. And, of course, now we face the German election in September. What it means for the United States is, though, that there seems to be real pushback. And it looks like Europe is not going in the direction of the United States.
And it seems in some ways, Anne McCarthy, then we'll turn over to Kate Whitehead, is that America in some ways is a much more deeply divided nation in that sense than appears that Europe and other nations are, just given the spread of the vote.
I just wonder, too, just to add to that, is that with what happened with our own elections here, if that really set the stage for what to come afterwards around the world. I mean, I look at Le Pen and I look at Macron, and I'm probably not pronouncing it right. Macron, I'm trying
Macron.
Here.
Macron.
Macron. But I look at the fact that Le Pen's an insider. I mean, her father ran in 2002. Thinking about Hillary Clinton as an insider, you know, her husband had been in office. Macron comes as an outsider. Trump comes in as an outsider. But when you look at the platforms of Trump and Le Pen, they're so closely connected in terms of you know, their stance on immigration, the stance on closing the border, the stance on kind of America first or France first, and being a, you know, a deeply divided nation. And Macron, in terms of his policies, seems so similar in a sense to Hillary Clinton, and the idea of going forward and looking to open up the world and looking to bring in all these voices. So you have these candidates on both sides, and you see a completely different turn of events in each case. And what's going to happen to America, I think it's going to be interesting going forward, because we really have to think about who is in charge of our country, what does that mean to the rest of the world, how people are viewing us, and how people are taking our policies and then using that to make decisions in their own countries.
Anne?
I think it's structural, and this is why. They had a runoff a week ago, and if we had had a runoff full of, say, 10 to 12 candidates, it might not have been Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump.
Sure.
And somebody in the middle might have risen to the top. Because I think Americans are divided, but I think our electoral system of closed primaries make us more divided. Mm-hmm. Because the far right and the far left of each party pulls its candidates way to the left or to the right, and then they scramble to kind of get in the middle. And in the end, nobody knows what anybody stands for except that somebody's the outsider. Whereas all the other elections tend to have a different system. And I think we should think about having a different system. I love this rank order voting and choice voting and not party driven. Only two parties get to compete for the vote of everybody.
No, I think there's something very antiquated about our voting system. And I think the Electoral College is, I wanted to dust off my old bumper sticker from 25 years ago, which is end the Electoral College.
Or from Bush v. Gore. We can go
back. Yeah, right. I mean, and even before that, I mean, it was always to me an arcane institution that needs to just go.
Well, there are two problems or two issues that are going on at the same time. One is electors are in the Constitution. So to get it out of the Constitution takes a constitutional amendment,
which is
almost literally impossible to get through Congress with two-thirds of both houses and then three-quarters of the states ratifying. On the other hand, there is another move among the states, and they've gotten actually nine states in the District of Columbia so far to agree to this, that whoever wins the popular vote in that state automatically gets all their electoral votes. Oh, excuse me. Whoever gets all the popular vote in the United States gets all that state's electoral votes. So, for example,
that's
a way of changing the system from within, because you can't, like you said, yes. The constitutional part is not going to happen.
The constitutional part is very, very difficult. It's such a high bar, and if you think about the number of times in which the Constitution has been, this is something I go over with my students all the time. There are 27 amendments to the Constitution, but I really look at it as more like 15, because the first 12 were in the very beginning, founding period, and they were just tinkering with the thing, trying to get it right. And then you have two other amendments, prohibition and repeal of prohibition, which cancel each other out. And then you look at the 27th Amendment itself, which was first among the number of amendments that were sent to the states by James Madison and the Congress in 1791. It just wasn't ratified until 200 years later. So it's really very difficult. But this other move is a possibility. If all the states said, whoever wins the national popular votes, we will automatically give our electoral votes to that candidate, that would mean that the popular vote winner would be the president of the United States.
Except it only seems to come up as an issue whenever it doesn't work. Whenever we have a system where the popular vote and the Electoral College kind of line up with each other, no one even thinks about it. I mean, we thought about it with Bush v. Gore, thought there was going to be an overhaul and some changes made there, but we moved in, we accepted it, and here we are again with Trump and Clinton. So it only becomes an issue when it's an issue. Other than that, people seem to, when I speak to my students, they had no idea that the popular vote can go one way and the Electoral College can go another way, and the way of the Electoral College becomes the president, not the will of the people. And I think that's fascinating.
And it is rare.
Yeah.
It's only five times.
Yeah.
And?
I'd agree. It's rare. I mean, President Obama won both times.
Yeah.
By handily.
Right.
You know, I agree that Le Pen sort of stunned people because she got over 30%. But he really trounced her. Let's look at it the other way. 66% of the vote is an amazing win. And I think that the French were voting for the middle of the road more than anything else.
Well, it was more than Warren Harding, who got 60%. that's the highest.
I think what you saw, I mean, I think in France was that a number of people who were on the left really garnered a lot of votes in France. Mm-hmm. But what the French do when they come together is go, as they've done in the past, which is we can't allow this person to become president of France. And they all gather around Macron to say, no, we just can't allow this.
Right.
And so I think that's the power of if we had actually had a runoff in this country, and those as Anne was saying,
right,
who knows what would have happened? I mean, and who knows who might have won the plurality of votes in America?
Well, one of the issues that Macron is going to face is that he has no political party.
Right.
I mean, En Marche, his party, which means basically onward.
which I agree with in theory.
Right. Where, though? I mean, you can go onward in different directions. But normally, the French system was a Gaullist system. Charles de Gaulle set this Fifth Republic up when he returned to France to become the first president of the Fifth Republic, that he was absolutely certain that he would be a very powerful president, and he would control the legislature, the National Assembly, and the Senate, and that the prime minister, which we don't have, they have a combination parliamentary presidential system, that the prime minister would be his puppet. And that worked until Chirac, who is a right-wing president, found himself facing a Lionel Jospin, who was a socialist prime minister. And they tried to get along, and they called it cohabitation, which we use in different terms these days.
Yes, we do.
But Macron has no party, and he's going to face a major election for the National Assembly next month in June. And maybe some of his people will be elected, but we'll have to wait to see how this works out.
I agree with Jack, but I have to say, I'm not sure President Trump has a party.
Well, he seems to be forming one.
I mean, and then people seem to be signing up very quickly. I was just going to add very quickly, I think that this other thing that has come out of the election of Trump, because I think so many negative things have come, but I'm really looking at some of the positive things, like people standing up, people making their voice known, people who've previously been on the sideline now joining in into the discussions. It's also the way in which people are talking about international events in ways that they haven't in a very long time.
Yeah.
I mean, under Obama, we seem to be very focused on what was happening in our own country, focused on our own president, focused on allowing Obama to do the work, either you liked him or you didn't. But under Donald Trump, people are very focused on what's happening outside of this country and how it impacts us.
Well, the Republicans, I don't know that they've done this as a party, clearly not, have no less than trotted out Condoleezza Rice now to talk about how we are going in the wrong direction under this president. She is all over the news, which is very interesting.
Her new book.
She's definitely on the book tour.
Yes.
Well, you know, books are published at certain points in time.
Right.
Right. I mean, she's at the right time here.
Right.
But she is voicing what we used to think of as a solid Republican thinker and policymaker.
She's really smart.
There's Condoleezza Rice. Mark and I were just talking about Howard Baker, Everett Dirksen. I mean, these were people where when Republicans and Democrats could actually join together and negotiate a piece of legislation and get it through Congress and to the president, rather than having it being the Speaker of the House only with the Freedom Caucus in the House and the president, and committee chairmen are completely left off, as well as the committees to get the health care bill through.
And that was probably, and Republicans that you could relate to as a Republican.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure, right?
Republicans made sense under Condoleezza Rice, who does have a clear voice. I mean, I think about when you roll out someone to speak for the party. Condoleezza Rice, I would argue, is an excellent choice. She's very smart. Her stance on foreign policy, the fact that she has the experience. I mean, I am not a Republican, but when she speaks, I tend to listen and think about what she's talking about in a very thoughtful way.
Well, she is a thoughtful person, and she is an optimistic person. And you can hear her, you can hear the teacher in her, because she sort of brings the person along about both the pros and cons of what she's talking about, but she always comes back to the pros.
Right.
So, folks, join us here. Your thoughts, 410-319-8888. Now, let's leap into the United States for a minute. As we've been inching this way in our conversation about Condoleezza Rice, does Trump have a party? And what just happened in? And who invited him to the party anyway? But this, sorry, sorry. But the question though is, what just happened in Congress with this healthcare vote? You know, you can look at people who like Donald Trump saying, "Oh, he knows now how to corral votes. Got people together to make this vote happen." You can look at the other side of it, saying many Republicans were just fed up with losing and said, okay, we'll pass something. We don't even know what it is. We're going to pass it anyway. And they did. But then there are all kinds of consequences to this vote that just took place that could have – I mean, it's – you know, then he talks to the Australian prime minister, saying they have a great health care system, which is basically a single-payer system that they have in Australia, right? But this kind of eliminates things like the guaranteed price protections for people with pre-existing conditions because it throws it back to the states. Even though rates have gone up under what we call Obamacare, and they have, they're going to go up again in Maryland, most likely, that this could raise them even further. It could mean more people thrown off those roles. You know, you have people – in a column this morning, someone quoted Congressman Labrador from Idaho, who said nobody dies because they didn't have access to health care.
Okay.
What?
Yes, just has the marked silence that should follow that stupid sentence, actually.
And of course, this study showed – the Harvard study showed 45,000 people died because of lack of access to health care. So what does this take – all this politically, do we think? And what does this really mean? It has a long way to go to get to the Senate. Senators, there's a lot more opposition there. But Anne, let me let you begin.
Well, I think that it won't pass in the Senate. And I think probably, I mean, clearly we're not listening like flies on the wall, but I suspect Paul Ryan finally has decided we can't just be the party of no. We voted against this Obamacare for how many? How many votes did they take?
Almost 60.
Yeah. And, right.
At
and
least.
Then when it's their turn to really overhaul it or, you know, repeal and replace, they can't get it together to do it. It's just egg on his face as well as President Trump's. But I think that they, you know, this was safety pinned together, and it may fall apart quickly.
I would say this. I don't think the Senate's going to take this bill up. I think they're going to try to write their own bill, and then they're going to have to go to conference, and then they're going to come up with a bill that the Freedom Caucus, which had agreed to the bill that passed the House, will not agree to, and we're going to be back to square one. That's just a prediction that perhaps is based on pure speculation, but that's what I think is going to happen.
Yeah, of course, I don't think it's going to pass. I think what is concerning is that it has gotten this far. I mean, I agree with what Anne is saying. It seemed to be safety pinned together. It seemed to be some type of, you know, last-ditch effort that we have to do something. We have been stalled. We haven't done nothing. We're looking like we're a party that just can't seem to make any decisions, pull together, be the party of no party, which is what Anne was saying. Maybe Trump doesn't have a party. We've got to do something. So let's just do this. Let's put this out there and see and show people that we can come together and make a decision. Unfortunately, it is horrible when you think about the type of things they call pre-existing conditions. I mean, I've been looking at a lot of the feminist sites and their responses to the fact that rape is a pre-existing condition and, you know, having, what is it, postpartum depression is a pre-term condition. What is this about in terms of the fact that there's a war on?
Or Jimmy Fallon's little boy who was just born with a congenital heart disease.
And I don't know if you saw
his
piece.
Condition.
I don't know if you saw his
covered.
Piece on
not
Facebook. Just about, you know, Jimmy Fallon. He did a whole piece on Facebook and it was on Twitter, but he talked about what was happening with his son and he talked about Obamacare and what does it mean for people who cannot afford health care when your child is born with this type of condition. You know, the hundreds of thousands of dollars it's going to cost. It was an amazingly just distinct and clear and thoughtful piece, and even President Obama actually responded to it and said, you know, this is what we're talking about in terms of giving people the coverage they need. We know Obamacare is not perfect.
Too many people have pre-existing health conditions that are actually living healthy lives. This, I mean, I agree. And I would also say that the sense that there is no individual mandate, but if you're off of insurance for, 2 months, then suddenly you're penalized? That's the same exact thing. And it's like a shell game. And people may be dumb enough to have elected Donald Trump, but they're not that dumb when it comes to their health care.
Yeah. I hope you're right.
Yeah. One would hope so.
One thing everybody's waiting for. The Congressional Budget Office has not yet scored this, or at least said publicly. And the last time they did, in the first American Health Care Act that never went to the House because they didn't have the votes, gave it a really, really awful score for so many people, particularly those on Medicaid. This bill is worse in every respect, and I can't imagine that the score is going to be any better when they finally come up with it.
I mean,
do you, rem- remember, I think it was Bush, I can't remember what election it was, but it wasn't the Tea Party, was in its nascent kind of growing mode, and somebody in Florida had a sign that said, keep your government hands off my Social Security.
It was Medicare.
Medicare.
Medicare, right. Don't touch my Medicare.
We are now used to Obamacare, right or wrong. I mean, I think it does need to be tweaked here and there, but everything does. That's not a criticism of the Affordable Care Act. People have gotten used to it. And to take something away that they've gotten used to is, I mean, that's just, no wonder the Democrats were saying, na-na-na-na.
Yeah. Goodbye. But
I'm sorry.
But I was just going to say, under Obamacare, and we can call it Obamacare, that phrase was used by the Republicans who, like Mitch McConnell and those who hated Obama and Obama in the White House for a variety of reasons. A lot of it had to do with race.
Yes.
But once the president himself began to call it Obamacare, it legitimized the term. So I think it's perfectly legal, or not legal, but legitimate to call it Obamacare. But 20 million people were able to get on health care. Now, that's the upside. I mean, it has been expensive. There's no question about that.
And the cost needs to be tweaked.
And it has to be. Yeah. So instead of repeal and replace, maybe repeal and repair.
I think what's interesting is that people are looking at, you know, the members of the House and the tweets that have gone out. You have millionaires who can afford and receive excellent health care. Making decisions about people who cannot afford to keep basic health care. You seem like it's a big overhaul, and you're kind of making a stand against Obamacare, against President Obama and everything he's done, but you're not looking at the real impact of people who are benefiting from this.
So if you look at the some of the latest polls, I think it might be a Quinnipiac poll before the Freedom Caucus pushed it even further out. People were asked the question, do you approve or disapprove of the Republican health care plan? 17% approved. 56% did not approve. What kind of impact do you think the Republican health care plan would have on your health care? How many people said positive impact? 12%. Negative impact? 30. Not much impact? Half the people. And what would be the effect of a Republican health care plan on insurance? More Americans would be covered? Only 8% believe that. Fewer? 61%. And so, I mean, I think that, and people are actually right. I mean, about what's going to happen with this plan and what it really means. But there's a whole lot more that's going on here, though. I think we need to wrestle with as well. There's things happening in the EPA. There are more issues around urban America and where money is being cut by this Trump administration and for our cities across the country. And there will be no more investigations of police forces under this attorney general. All that coming up. So we're going to take a short break and come right back to tackle all this with all the doctors in the house. Dr. Fuchman, Dr. McCarthy, and Dr. Whitehead with prescriptions for our country. And you may get yours at 410-319-8888. We'll be right back. Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner. Welcome back to our National News Roundtable. And programs like this are brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, has been helping its members and its community prosper for the last 80 years. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. Belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com. or at steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. I am here with Dr. Kay Whitehead, Associate Professor of Communication and African and African-American Studies at Loyola University, Maryland, Dr. Ann McCarthy, Dean of the Business School at Hamline University in Minneapolis, and Dr. Jack Fruchtman, who is Professor of Political Science at Towson University. And you all are 410-319-8888. Marie, you're on the air. Welcome.
To you all.
Good morning.
I want to bring up these points I've heard. But over in France, a lot of people didn't vote, as well as here in the United States, they haven't been voting. I'd like to hear your comments. I'll hang up.
Okay. Jack, you mentioned that before we went on the air.
Yeah. Under the electoral system in France, you can actually file a blank ballot, and apparently around 9% of the voters yesterday in the electorate filed blank ballots. And, of course, some didn't vote at all. They just stayed home. But still, the representation in the elections in Europe are always extremely high compared to the United States. our highest votes are when we have presidential elections. But when there's no presidential election, even if there's a gubernatorial election in for example, the state of Maryland, the numbers are low. And sometimes 25, 30, 35, 40% at maybe the highest. France yesterday, I think it actually, they were low.
75%.
Yes, but that's low for France.
That's low for France.
That's
high
low for
us.
France. That's extremely high for the United States.
But right.
It's very, very low. It's, yeah. So.
I wondered about that. I mean, I know that with this notion of filing the blank vote, which I agree with, you're saying you participate in the process. You don't support either of the candidates,
right.
But you are participating in the process. I was thinking about that against the complacency here in America. Why don't people vote? I know it's a universal question. We've talked about it a lot on this show, but I'm always just puzzled by the fact that people don't feel that their vote actually matters. But then, of course, and I guess I'm kind of answering my own question, then you have the Electoral College and the popular vote, and you're shown again and again, yes, your vote doesn't matter. We want you to get out and vote, but even if you all get out and vote one way, the Electoral College can swoop in, make a different decision from the popular vote. So how do we convince people to vote when we show them in these five cases, Bush v. Gore, of course, Trump, Clinton are the two most recent ones, that your vote actually doesn't count? Because in the end, the popular vote can say one thing, Electoral College can say something else, and the Electoral College does determine who's going to be president.
I'm going to say something sort of structural again, like the runoff issue as opposed to our two-party issue. Why do we vote on a Tuesday? I understand why the historical precedent
right.
that was set, but most other democracies vote on a Sunday
yeah.
or a Saturday. And yes, people do work over the weekends. I'm not saying that they don't. But a far greater majority of us work on Tuesday than we do on a mm-hmm. Sunday. Why don't we make it easier for people to vote?
And we could actually make it, if I've always been an advocate of having a three-day voting period, you know, Saturday, Sunday, Monday.
Right.
Many people work Sundays or off Mondays. So, I mean, you can create a system that gets more people out to vote by giving them 3 days to come out and
rather
make
than
the
just
vote.
One.
Right, and
okay,
just,
as a candidate that shook hands at the polls, I don't like that idea.
Well, we do have early voting. I mean, early voting is perhaps one of the ways to
which
get
has been
around
attacked,
it,
though.
Which has been attacked.
Right.
Largely because it does allow people to get out to vote, and the higher the vote, sometimes is not very good for some candidates of some political coloration.
Well, no, 3-1.
In Minnesota, this time around, there was a high turnout in the rural areas, and Minnesota almost, for the first time ever, looked a little purple instead of deep blue because more rural voters were voting.
Well, you know, that, yeah, I mean, that North Country up there, Wisconsin, even Minnesota.
Yeah. Came out.
Michigan.
There's always been a very strong conservative element. I mean, America has always had this powerful conservative movement. I mean, it was tied up in a lot of very complex things about our country, you know. Our country is probably in some ways further right than, or had been, than a good rest of the planet.
Well, part of the reason that we have electors instead of popular votes was the same reason why United States senators were originally elected by state assemblies and not by the people. That only changed in 1913. So to me, that's not very long ago that we've actually had direct election of senators. The reason for that is that the framers of the Constitution, people like James Madison, whom we always admire, and Hamilton, whom we has gotten more press than any other founder in history, as far as I can see, did not trust us.
Right.
Did not trust
right.
us.
Right.
So they had people. These barriers.
After this election, maybe they don't trust
yeah.
us either.
Well, but I think it would be interesting to see that there might be an uptick. I mean,
yeah.
when Donald Trump comes up for re-election, I really suspect if the trend continues like it is now, that more people will get out and vote
it's
in
possible.
This next election.
Let me go through the phones and see what our listeners are thinking, and then I have a question for you all about the EPA and what that portends for the next bunch of years. 410-319-8888. Stephen in Baltimore, you're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, thank you.
Good morning.
So good morning to you. I just wanted to say that on that, the French system, in terms of having a multi-party system, not just having two parties that absorb various factions and hope that a candidate will represent it, but actually have their own candidates running, where the multiple parties are allowed to participate in the debates. Like you saw far right and far left parties participating in televised debates. That, you know, something that we don't see. A commission, right now we just have a commission between the Democrats and the Republicans that determines, you know, what the terms of the debate are, and that's it. And then on top of that, you know, you all just mentioned the Electoral College system, and I think it's just going to be I don't know if the Democrats will make this decision, but seeing as how they've lost two of the past five presidential elections due to having the popular vote but losing the Electoral College, are they going to ever make a decision to say we need to get rid of the Electoral College and make that a main aspect of our plank, a main plank of our campaign?
Mm-hmm.
You know, a multi-party system would be great. I think right now the only people who are calling for real major structural change in the Electoral College system are third parties, and that's the reason why you can in France you can see why there was a rejection of far right was because third parties the multi-party system allowed all of these other parties to express their point and coalesce around, you know, the centrist candidate, I guess. In addition to the runoff voting, I also need to mention the fact that they have a instant runoff voting system.
Right. And that, you know, if we had a runoff here, let's say Baltimore City, the last mayoral election, it's no telling who might have won that election.
That would have been very interesting.
If it was Sheila Dixon and Catherine Pugh in a runoff, I mean, that to me is where democracy should live.
Yes.
Right? And not in this, not as I think Anne has been talking about. If you look at the French election, then I want to ask a totally different question here. I was just looking at it again. So in that runoff, Macron had 24% of the vote, and Le Pen.
In the first round, had
21%. But, you know, so you had a number of other people on the left that ran, and they combined, the two top candidates there, combined for almost 27% of the vote. So, I mean, and then there were others. So it was clearly, France is a divided nation as well, left and right, but they clearly coalesced to make sure that Ms. Le Pen would not be president.
Just one observation, in my judgment, this nation has always been, our nation has always been a two-party country. Every other party, no matter how many there are, as the caller noted, are called third parties.
Right.
They have never gotten traction. We've never been able to say that a third party, the American Party, the Freedom Party, whatever you want to call it, has never been able to get any traction in the electoral system.
Perhaps the last time in America, then I do want to ask a question about the EPA. The last time the United States had an election where there were multiple parties and really affected the election, maybe it was 1860.
Okay.
Right?
Going all the way back,
when there were
four
parties running, all took major votes, right, where Abraham Lincoln won with a minority of the vote.
Exactly.
In 1860.
Right.
You know, that was probably the last time I can think. That's, I mean, there were, in 1912, there were several parties running.
Well, yes. Okay, Teddy Roosevelt created the Progressive Party.
You had the Socialist Party.
Basically the Republicans were split between Taft and Teddy Roosevelt.
Right.
And that's how Woodrow Wilson slipped in.
Right. So, I mean, there have been a few times in our history where that's happened.
Yeah, but it's rare.
But that's right.
But people don't even see us as a third party. Those of us who live here, see, we have two parties. And for those who are kind of on the fringe, you have third parties. I mean, what's interesting, they don't see it as being a part of the process. And maybe it's the training that takes place, because when you start having the national debates, you don't see other candidates. You see either it's the Democratic debate or Republican debate. And you see, I understand the lock on that. I mean, the politics behind that. But you train people to see the nation and continue moving the nation in this two-party system.
The question becomes what happens inside the two parties that we have.
Right.
I mean, you've got one party that goes from moderate to left. The other one goes from moderate to right, but they're all having this interesting warfare internally at the moment. Both parties. The only thing that unites the Democrats right now is Trump, but they're internally they are in gridlock and in a battle over who represents what.
That's right.
But see, I thought we were going to see kind of a rise of a third party. After the election of Trump, I thought that we were primed to see the rise of another party. And people were on the fringe. They were upset. They were angry. And I thought, okay, we're going to start seeing the building of all these parties. The Green Party is going to grow. The Socialist Party is going to grow. And it seemed like people have come back to the Democratic Party saying, help us to make the work.
It takes something like the abolition of slavery to explode the internal workings of a party that happened with in the 1850s. I mean, that's
now,
what
I wonder if the election of Trump is on that same level.
You never know. No.
I'm being tongue in cheek, but so, the idea is that when you talk about 5 million people marching around the world the day after, it was a major explosion. Not on the same level, of course, as ending American enslavement, but in terms of the way people reacted.
So I do want to get to the EPA here. What are you about to say, Ann?
I was going to say third-party candidates have certainly been spoilers. One could argue that Ralph Nader gave George W. Bush the election, and Ross Perot probably gave it to Clinton, and John Anderson gave it to Reagan. But you're right; we'd have to go way back. But you have to. But we should remember Washington and John Adams didn't believe in parties.
Right.
It was Thomas Jefferson who gave us the party system.
That's correct.
That's right.
There were no parties in 1789.
Right. No
but they were by the time of the end of the first administration of George Washington.
And I don't know why we have to have parties to have multiple candidates.
Right.
Why don't we have multiple candidates from both parties?
Right.
So a centrist Republican can run in a race and a runoff race against a right-leaning Republican, and a centrist Democrat can run in the same race with left Democrats. And people get a choice among five or six.
Right.
No, I completely agree.
Out of there.
So just turn our attention just for a moment here. There's two things I try to bring up here if we have time. So so the EPA has dismissed five members of a major scientific review board. And they're going to replace them with, they say, people from the industries they regulate.
The claim is that their term is up.
That's the claim.
Right.
Okay.
But they're saying
they've served a three-year term. They've come to the end.
But they're not looking to other scientists to take their place.
No, oil and gas industry people.
Right.
University-affiliated researchers was a term they also bandied about for a while there.
Right, because they left some of these university-affiliated researchers are paid by Exxon and all the rest to do their due in the university, despite what my
insider
friend
lobbyist
Rick Best says.
That's why I'm a social scientist. I don't get anything.
You're lucky you have a job.
But what does this mean? Like, what does this trend mean? Are we going to start seeing people being removed, I guess the ones who work in the field, and being replaced by those who want to actually regulate and kind of direct and dictate the direction of the field? University-affiliated researchers who receive money from ExxonMobil, you know, they have a different agenda than a scientist who's thinking about this, we would hope, with kind of a big picture effect.
Well, the EPA has been on the chopping block with Donald Trump since the campaign when he said it was a hoax, a Chinese hoax, by the way. That's climate change is a Chinese hoax that's been made us think about these things. The EPA is set to be cut by over 30%. Scott Pruitt, when he was Attorney General of Oklahoma, sued the EPA at least 15 times. And so it's clear that what we think as protections in the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act and things of that nature are going to be looked at very differently by this administration.
So, folks, what do you think? 410-319-8888. I mean, there's lots of things here. There's this and there's things we don't talk about, which is the most what came to my mind, given the what's just happened in New Orleans and what's been happening around the country in Texas with police shootings again, that we have an administration now that clearly is going to take a hands-off approach and is not going to call for any investigations.
Okay, Mark, I know you don't want the conversation to go in this direction because you didn't list it as one of your things, but
no.
I say this to my Democrat friends all the time. When is the House and the Senate going to get some guts and impeach President Trump? Look what he's doing. Look what his administration is doing in China.
Yeah.
They're giving out visas in exchange.
Oh,
I saw that this morning.
Yes.
Nicole Meyer.
Finish your sentence, Ann.
Well, Jared's
sister. I mean, if that's not a conflict of interest, first, the guy doesn't release his taxes. Okay, there's no, you know, constitutional whatever that makes him do that. But there is a constitutional, there are clauses in the Constitution, the Emoluments is the first, that says no conflict of interest. And he clearly has a conflict of interest. And everybody's worried about I'm worried about the EPA too. But these are distractions from the fundamental problem, the fundamental corruption that is at the core of the Trump administration.
Well, you hit on them. You said, when are they going to get some guts? I think behind them getting guts, when is the American public going to push them to make some type of stand and seek to impeach him? I definitely agree. I see the conflict of interest. I see Donald Trump as a whole. The institution of Donald Trump is a distraction because we spend time on Monday morning, whenever I'm watching Morning Joe and flipping through the channels, we're all talking about his tweets over the weekend. At the same time, the EPA quietly announced this on Friday. So it wasn't even part of the major news cycle. The things that happened in China with the visas, they're quietly talking about this. And we're more focused on him, the institution, than on all these things that are happening that are impeachable acts.
But amen.
Right. And nobody in the media really is talking about them in that way.
The problem with impeachment is the same problem with constitutional amendments. The House is controlled by the Republicans. I cannot see the Republicans impeaching him. And you need 2/3 of the Senate to remove him from office. And I don't see that. I may be wrong about that, but it's such a high bar. No president has ever been removed from office. Mm-hmm. They've been impeached. That is, the House is impeached, but it's up to the Senate to convict with 2/3. And that's the problem. And we saw it last with Bill Clinton and go back to the 19th century with Andrew Johnson, who actually was almost booted from office. It was only one vote in the Senate that kept him in office.
It's interesting that you mentioned Clinton because I've thought about that because I was listening to Monica Lewinsky's TED Talk because she, roll your eyes up in your head, but she was on the TED Hour just kind of talking about being pushed into the national spotlight. But the question I had was not about Lewinsky, not about the dress, not about that, but the notion that in that instance, he did not get enough votes that would allow him to be impeached. If it couldn't happen in that instance, with all of that information, all of that proof, all that investigation, all of the horror and shock from the American public, how do we expect in this particular situation, people are not really quite even understanding the level of the impeachable acts of Donald Trump. How can we expect with all of this gray area for people to be able to come together and say, you must impeach this man?
And, you know, again, my history hat goes back on my head. I was thinking about Andrew Johnson.
I love that hat.
That's one of my favorite hats.
That's your favorite hat.
So Andrew Johnson had no vice president.
No.
Right?
Right.
So if he was impeached, I mean, that impeachment process was really critical because his lack of impeachment is what helped destroy Reconstruction.
Right.
That allowed him to destroy what was being created as a truly egalitarian America that was on the road to that. Despite, you know, now that we finally have historians who really understand Reconstruction and don't make it as this horrible period of time because in their own little racist ways of analyzing our world.
Right.
But that was a very critical time, as is this.
But yeah.
And he does have a vice president, so I'm not so sure I want him impeached.
Well, that's
the next question.
That's right. Mike Pence is smart.
And very smart.
And I think even farther to the right. Well, I can't say farther to right because Donald Trump does not have an ideology.
Right.
I mean, he has no political principles except to, quote, win.
Correct.
I mean, winning is it. And his own personality and his own standing in American society. That's
his
it.
His own sense of right and wrong, which is just amazing to watch the process play out, but also to keep yourself from getting so caught up in watching the process like it's a television show at work, with trying to remain honest that this is the way he is running American
reality
policy. This is a real reality show that can have some detrimental consequences on the ways in which we're seen, who we go to war with, how we're going to be viewed as an international policymaker. People see it as fun and games, and I think that moment of laughing at Donald Trump and making him the butt of jokes, I think that moment has passed because we're getting into very dangerous territory now.
And I hear you about to say something.
No, I agree. I totally agree. But except that, you know, I know people say Pence will be worse than Trump, and in some sense, maybe that's right. I mean, I have to really think about that because while Donald Trump is a terrible embarrassment, he really, in my opinion, does not have a party. They are at odds with each other. They pass a continuing resolution, but they don't put money in for his fence. And they want replace and repeal, but they can't get the Freedom Caucus to go along with it until, you know, they twist some arms and the Senate's out there. I mean, there's a lot of stalemate going on right within the Republican Party. And from where I sit, that might be a good thing. Whereas with Mike Pence in the White House, there won't be that stalemate.
I wonder with Mike Pence in the White House, because he is a skilled and seasoned politician, if we will go back to the days I think about, you know, with the second Bush, you know, the kind of decide and announce policies that were taking place, where you close the ranks of the White House, where you don't use any form of social media. And of course, Bush, of course, did not have access to social media the same way Trump has. With Trump, we have a clear idea of what he's doing. Everything, he is an open sieve. Everything is kind of flowing out. But I wonder with the more traditional politician in the White House, with Pence in place, that we will have a closed door policy and you will only hear about it as it's quietly announced days after it has taken place. It's a different type of way of viewing the White House and a different type of way of doing policy in a way that people are used to. They're not used to knowing every single thing that's happening.
So people have to remember that Mike Pence in Indiana created some of the toughest, most restrictive voter suppression laws in the country.
Yes. Oh, my word.
Aimed at black folks.
Yes.
Aimed at students for not being able to vote in Indiana.
The way he attacked the LGBTQ community.
So not to be sanguine about a Pence presidency.
But thinking about the long-term impact, and that's what I mean about this quiet announcement of policies, decide and announce. That's a dangerous place to be.
To the phones at 410-319-8888. Jasmine, you're on the air. Welcome. Hi, Jasmine. You're there? Welcome.
Hi, yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
So I have a two-parter, and I really hope that you guys are able to answer me.
Okay.
The first thing is, I feel very strongly that Donald Trump should be impeached. And I think that the greatest issue is that the American people are not educated on what the actual constitutional infractions that are happening. But I feel like it should be a mass block of infomercials outlining, here's the law, here's what he's done, here's the proof, and playing it on loop. And two, how do we address Paul Ryan and the Republican agenda that is being rammed through at the expense of the American people, with them saying, even though Trump is horrible and corrupt, we don't care because we're about to get our way? If you could really detail those answers to those two questions, it would really help, because every day I wake up angry and anxious, but I'm also very much more involved in the political process than I've ever been. And I appreciate that. It was a great conversation.
Thank you so much. So who wants to tackle these things first? Jack?
Well, under the Constitution, the Emoluments Clause, which is what people are pointing to mainly, is that nobody can receive gifts or financial benefits from their official activities and duties. Donald Trump is the first president that we've had who came in as a billionaire president who has so many interests and financial interests not only in the United States but around the world. And his, even though he says that he has stepped away from the Trump Organization, he's still a beneficiary of this.
Right.
One of his senior advisors, his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has also done the same thing. But he is still the beneficiary of all of the things that the Kushner Company is able to do around the world. We mentioned his sister was in China.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And talking to very, very wealthy investors there, trying to get the Kushner family projects going. And we have this law that's been in effect for part of the U.S. Code. It's called EB-5. It's section EB-5 of the U.S. Code, that a person who invests at least $500,000 in a U.S. investment, you automatically get a green card, automatically, a visa. And that's very attractive to many foreign investors. And these are very wealthy people.
And we just left it. So that, I mean, that this is, you know,
I agree with what Dr. Whitehead was saying earlier about how with Pence as the president, things could get done very much behind closed doors without American people or knowledge. On the other hand, I don't think we can let a president flaunt, you know, just act totally against our Constitution, because then anybody who comes after him can do the same.
I just think it's surprising that we are now into, if I'm not mistaken, maybe the 106th day of the Donald Trump presidency.
That's all.
I think. If you think about it, it feels like it's been years. I mean, we talked about this earlier. I think it was a week after the election. We were on Steiner Show talking about the fact that it's been 7 days. Nobody has slept. We're all staying up. We're all on edge. That feeling has not dissipated at all. But the fact that this is happening, people are not surprised. It's happening before our eyes. It's not like Donald Trump is doing these things in the dark. It's not like the Trump family is not becoming the most powerful family on the planet right before our very eyes because of all of this interest that he has, all of his business developments. I mean, he is directly benefiting. They will be multi-billionaires by the time he leaves office. And it is happening, and he's not being stopped.
Right. And they'll change the tax code at the same time so that they don't have to pay taxes on all the things that they managed to benefit from while they were.
I mean, this probably will have more of an effect on the coming elections than it will on any sense of impeachment. I mean, any chance of an impeachment happening, I think.
The problem with the by-election, and it still is a problem, it's not as much of a problem as it was, say, a couple of weeks ago, is that most of the senators up for re-election are Democrats. 25 senators are Democrats. And some of them are in Trump states.
Right.
And that's the problem with that. And people are now saying, with the House passing this Health Care Act, that maybe some of the vulnerable Republicans are now at risk. But we'll see. Yeah, we'll see
about
that.
Yeah, I'm not. You know, people are just going crazy about the Democrats are going to win and.
I'm not sure.
That's
reality. I don't think we should get cocky at all. We were cocky before, and look what happened on the 20th. We were very cocky. I think we should be more cautious and really make sure people are getting out to the polls and that people are making their voices heard.
And even someone who's not part of necessarily the we, I don't think that's going to be. It's going to be very hard. I mean, this is very difficult to kind of defeat. The way the states have their own congressional districts, as in Maryland, gerrymandered to protect the party in power.
Right.
Oh, that's right.
It's very difficult. I mean, Maryland has the same way. I mean,
absolutely.
You know, it's gerrymandered in favor of the Democrats in this state.
Right. That's the way we do it.
Which is just absurd. All that just adds to me the absurdity of the entire system.
Yeah.
Right.
That doesn't allow a true representation to take place in this country.
Right. And it's not going to change until people kind of make that stand that they're going to push against it. I know I was listening to it. You know, was saying that it's almost impossible to change the Constitution. Almost impossible. It's hard. I mean, I don't teach about the amendments to the same extent that you do. I focus on a few of them. But the notion of how difficult it is to get the amendment in there. And then, of course, to have the two that cancel each other out, that people don't realize that the other power that they have is the power within their own states, which is why those gubernatorial elections are so important. Getting out and voting for the people who actually represent you every day, to not be so focus on the president. That's not going to get the lights fixed on your block. That's not going to get books in your school, but being focused on these other elections that are just as important.
So we have to wrap this up. Quick closing thought. Yeah, we're done.
I think.
For the hour anyway.
I think that the American people have to be very vigilant. They have to continue to watch what goes on in Washington, especially in the White House. This is so critical.
And you got 10 seconds worth of Ann McCarthy? Or 15 maybe?
I'm looking forward to 2 years from now. We'll see.
All right. I want to thank all of you so much. That was Dr. Ann McCarthy, Dean of Business School at Hamline University, Dr. Kay Whitehead, Associate Professor of Communication, African American Studies at Loyola University of Maryland, Dr. Jack Fruchtman, Jr., Professor of Political Science at Towson. Good to have all three of you with us.
Thank you.
Thanks
as
so
always.
Much.
Thank you, Mark.
Stay tuned, folks. We're going to have a conversation about the Battle of Black Tom with the great Victor Laval, and then take a look at some comic books. Don't go away.